people.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Well, it's that time again. The Ig Nobel Prizes for 2014 have been announced. What are the Ig Nobels? Well, longtime listeners know, but for those new to the show, here goes. The Ig Nobels are prizes awarded as a kind of parody of the Nobel Awards. I say kind of because to be nominated, a research paper has to sound ridiculous. It makes you laugh. But there's more to the prize than humor. The Ig Nobel tagline reads, "Research that makes people laugh and then makes you think." Famous Ig Nobel Prizes in the past are, "Do woodpeckers get headaches? Why don't pregnant women tip over? And can you predict when a cow will lie down?" Of course, my favorite, "Action needed to evaluate the impact of efforts to estimate costs of repairs and studies," which was, and I quote here, "a report about reports about reports that recommend the preparation of a report about reports about reports." Whew, you get the idea. So, on to this year's winners. Winning the prize for neuroscience was Jesus in the Toast. University of Toronto professor Kang Li et al., working both here and in China, studied the phenomenon of people seeing faces in objects like toast. Now, they did not attempt to answer the question as to whether the face of Jesus appeared was some form of miracle or not. Obviously, it wasn't. No, the real question they were asking is, why do we see things like faces? Because our eyes are fooled, or do they appear because our brain expects them? The technical jargon is, was this bottom-up or top-down phenomena? Well, using brain scans, they stated that our perception of the world, at least in regard to faces, is a very top-down phenomena. That is, if we expect to see a face, we will see a face, be damned what the eyes might actually perceive. How was the study done? They took pure noise image, think static on a TV. Oh wait, we don't have that anymore. Now it's pixelations. Well, think snow on a field. We still have snow. So they showed these images to participants. Half were told prior to viewing that there was a face to be seen, the other half that there was a letter. Note, there was no control group, that is, people who were allowed to spontaneously perceive whatever, but beyond that one minor weakness, it seemed to be an interesting study. Anyway, there's a specific part of the brain that lights up when we see someone's face. Their very same areas are illuminated when people were experiencing the pareidolia of seeing faces in snow, leading researchers to conclude that the priming, being told a face should be there, activated this region, and thus faces were seen. I could not find out if there is any correlation with areas of the brain and letter pareidolia. Oh, and for those who don't know, pareidolia is a phenomena like this where random or vague stimulus is perceived as specific or significant. Another famous example of this is to listen to a record backwards and hear, quote, hidden messages. Scientists believe we develop this bias to see things that may not actually be there to speed up our perceptual process. That when we are looking into a dense patches of leaves, we can more quickly see the snake that might kill us. Or as the old passage goes, it is better to mistake a bunch of leaves for a lion than a lion for a bunch of leaves. Another winner, this time for mental health, is it mentally hazardous for a human being to own a cat? This was awarded to three studies. One showing that 41% of people bit by cats were depressed, compared to only 29% of those bit by dogs. The research ventured that the correlation may be attributed to depressed people buying cats or cats being able to sense depression and being more aggressive. Of course, I said three studies. I could not help feel that the Ig Nobel group or the ones nominating this particular research added the cat biting human to sort of spice it up. As we have discussed in previous shows, correlation and causation are not the same. And if you think about it, there's only a 10% difference between cat and dog bites. Not to mention, the researchers were not sure whether or not the bites were the owners of the felines or not. But that aside, the other two studies were focused on toxoplasmosis and how it can affect human behavior. Cats are likely the leading cause of human toxoplasmosis, as they are a natural part of the life cycle of the parasite that causes the disease. In humans, more and more research, including these studies, are showing that not only are a great number of people infected with this parasitic disease and are unaware of it, but toxoplasmosis can cause significant changes to the psychology and behavior of people. Effects include lowering novelty seeking, lowering levels of guilt, less impulsiveness. Studies seem to show that it has an effect on lowering IQ in men, but elevating it in women. Although this may be an artifact of gender bias in the testing, it's still very interesting. There is also believed a link between toxoplasmosis and schizophrenia. So if you're a cat owner, well, likely the damage has already been done. So give Fluffy a saucer of milk, and remember, Fluffy is not alone there. No, she's teeming with little invisible squiggly things. Yes. Speaking of squishy things, okay, not my best segue, but it has more class than, oh, I don't know, slipping on a banana peel? Which brings us to the next award, that of physics. It went to research team investigating, well, let's just read the title of their award-winning paper. Frictional coefficient under banana skin. What was the purpose of this research? Well, and note, this comes from the Nobel website itself. It is, quote, to measure the amount of friction between a shoe and a banana skin, and between a banana skin and the floor. And when a person steps on a banana skin, that's on the floor. To perform this experiment, they got some shoes, leather-soled, some plain linoleum, some transducers to measure friction, a foot with human attached, and of course, banana peels. And they found out that, yes, indeed, when you step on a banana peel at anything greater than about a 4% angle, you would experience a significant reduction in friction, i.e. your foot would slip. Of course, one might ask, has not this, quote, experiment been done millions of times on film, TV, and the stage? Well, yes and no. This is one of those things so common, so universal, known to everyone, that no one has actually gone out and actually looked into it. And more importantly, perhaps, why do we slip? As it turns out, there's more than slipperiness going on. It seems the sugary gel that is in the peel gets squeezed out, which in turn is the source of the super slider effect. They compared it to a wet floor and other materials, notably apple skins, and the banana was king. And if you're wondering, the banana is 40 times more slippery than an apple peel. I'm not sure whether that means you should eat more apples than bananas, but they are definitely safer. On a side note, when I did a little digging, I discovered the research was published in the Tribology Online. Tribology? I thought, oh, some social science publication. You know, like the science of tribes. Of course, to be as rigorous on this paper as I would with one about GMOs, I checked out the publication, and much to my surprise, Tribology has nothing to do with tribes or biology. Of course, my Greek listening speakers have already laughed at me because they know that the root is not tribal, but tribo, Greek for to rub, obviously. Turns out this is a study of interacting surfaces in relative motion. It includes a study and application of principles of friction, lubrication, and wear. No, not sociology, but tribology is actually a branch of mechanical engineering and material science. Is my face red? This has been today's example of sarcasm. At least I think it's sarcasm. Another crap-debating study was on dogs. In particular, dogs doing their business. If you get what I mean. And yes, I went there. The Nobel Prize for Biology went to a group of researchers who examined if dogs are sensitive to magnetic fields. In a paper, innocently titled, Dogs Are Sensitive to Small Variations of Earth's Magnetic Fields, they measured the alignment of dogs with regards to north-south and east-west when they went poo or pee. Sorry, this is science. I mean, when the subjects defecated or urinated. Armed with over 7,000 observations of 70 dogs from almost 40 different breeds, they found that dogs prefer to align north-south when they do their business. Of course, there are some issues with the study I would like to investigate, but really, it's dogs pooing. Let's just let it go. Oh, but maybe it is serious, Don, some of you may say. This is a growing, if not in any way conclusive, evidence that mammals may have magnetoception, i.e. the ability to perceive magnetic fields. We have known for years now that many birds can see the Earth's magnetic field. There's good evidence that some invertebrates and insects can see these fields as well. In mammals, moles, rats, and some bats seem to feel the force. Perhaps adapting to their prey, the red fox has shown signs of sensitivity. More controversial, evidence showing similar magnetic alignment has been found and put forward for cows and deers. However, this, like the dog research, is at best controversial, but still interesting in its own way because some recent discoveries have shown a protein used by other animals to see magnetic fields has been found in the human eye. Of course, early days, and no one is really sure what role the protein truly plays in magnetoperception, nor what it does in the human eye. But it'd be really cool if you could take some eye drops or something to activate this superpower. Okay, of this year's rack of WTF research, this one has got to take the cake. I have been trying to ascertain why this would be something anyone would do. You might be slightly aware of the obsession with probiotics, especially in the context of yogurt and the like. It's been a very controversial but very big thing. It's kind of hard to avoid. But for those not acquainted, probiotics is based on our ever-expanding understanding of our own microbiome, the biosphere of bacteria and the like that call the human body home. Remember, cell for cell, there are about 10 non-human cells to every one human cells. We are never alone. Further, better health can be affected both positively or negatively because of this microbic jungle. Probiotics are bacteria we eat that then reside in our gut, supposedly providing beneficial effects. There is some evidence that this works, at least for some people. But there's lots of evidence and examples where our biome actually can turn bad, requiring a fecal transplant, usually in the form of a shake. Yummy. Anyway, the winner of the Nutritional Ig Nobel Awards goes to a group whose paper speaks volumes and leaves one, well, you'll understand, speechless. The award-winning paper is entitled Characterization of Lactic Acid Bacteria Isolated from Infant Feces as Potential Probiotic Starter Cultures for Fermenting Sausage. Think salami and pepperoni mixed with infant feces, kind of, not really, but I can't get that image out of my head. So let me translate. And this is taken from the study's abstract, more or less. They identified over 100 varieties of lactobacillus. These guys turn indigestible lactose into other digestible sugars. They are used to ferment things like yogurt, wine, cheese, kimchi, you kind of get the idea. So these bacteria were tested to see which ones would be a viable candidate for use in a commercial production of sausage. I can only assume some form of fermented sausage, and not the normal breakfast sausage. What I could find was, well, there's actually no specifics really mentioned. So who knows, you might be eating it now. Now, so far, no big issues. But continuing the translation of the paper's title, the source material for these bacterium, the feces of infants. Yes, they're making baby poo sausage. I'm not saying this is the weirdest food-related product I've ever heard of, but I'm really curious how they think they're going to market this one. As painful as the marketing challenge will be, the winner of the aesthetic prize may offer some help. This research team investigated the effects of good or bad art has on the pain threshold. To test this, they had their subjects look at some artwork and had them label them as either ugly, neutral, or good. Then they had the subjects look at these works or nothing while simultaneously shooting their hand with a laser. Yes, I said laser. I'm assuming no holes were made through the subject's hand, but this is really sort of a weird and maybe wonderful change because back in my day, in the olden days, in the olden times, and I mean like maybe 5 years ago, you used like a pinprick test or something like that to test pain thresholds. But no, we're up to shooting lasers at people's hands. And they did this all to judge whether art can affect the subject's experience of pain. And as it seems to turn out that, well, beauty does soothe the savage beast. If you are looking at beautiful art, your subjective experience of pain seems to be less. I am unsure whether you think my voice is ugly, neutral, or beautiful, but I hope it alters your subjective experience of what's about to come next. Our break. We'll be back after this. Thank you.
the best tool ever devised for understanding how.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
And we're back. In keeping with our theme about the ignobles, let's expand on some of the topics that have been covered. So, audio pareidolia. It's not quite the same as the Jesus in the toast, but it's something that's a lot easier to convey on a radio than saying, hey, do you see this? Do you see that? So, let's listen to an episode of Skeptoid, where he talks about audio pareidolia. Let's listen now.
You're listening to Skeptoid. I'm Brian Dunning from Skeptoid.com. When people talk backwards. Just when you thought there was nobody in the world crazier than yourself, along come people who believe that we all subconsciously say what we really mean in reverse, through the unconscious but deliberate choosing of careful words which, if played backwards, say what we actually mean. Get it? The idea is that if I think some coffee is really horrible but I still want to be polite, my brain will subconsciously choose words to make my polite compliment that, if played backwards, would say, this coffee stinks. Proponents of this hypothesis call it reverse speech, because they were really creatively inspired on the day they named it. This is a small group of people, I believe there were six of them at last count, who take this completely seriously and believe that a whole world of secret information and opportunities is waiting to be unlocked by analyzing people's speech in reverse. They turn first to world leaders, play their speeches backwards, and listen to learn what they believe is the truth underlying the speech. A leading advocate for reverse speech, also called backward masking or backmasking, is David John Oates, an Australian. He's written several books on the subject, and even used to have a syndicated radio show promoting his theory. Just about any time a reverse speech expert is interviewed on television, it's David John Oates. His website is reversespeech.com, and it's loaded with all the examples you could ever hope to hear, as well as quite a few products and services he'd like to sell you if you believe his claims. He believes strongly that the human brain secretly encodes its actual meaning in reverse into a person's normal speech. You can use this to your advantage in business by decoding what the people across the table are actually telling you. And you can even use it in personal development by listening to your own speech backwards and learning more about what you really want. One of the examples from reversespeech.com is of this man giving a talk.
More energy and money and effort.
And when you play it backwards, turns out he was trying to comfort you with the message, you're frightened, lean on me.
You're frightened, lean on me.
Pretty interesting, but not necessarily convincing to a skeptic. A skeptic is more likely to dismiss these guys as conspiracy nuts and laugh at what paranoid delusionals they are. But it's actually way cooler and more interesting and more constructive to ask if there is any science behind what they're claiming. I'm not talking about science supporting the claim that people say what they actually mean in reverse. I'm talking about science behind the perception of order from chaos. And it turns out there is good science behind it. The journal Science published an article in 1981 by Rimas, Rubin, Pisoni, and Carell called Speech Perception Without Traditional Speech Cues. By playing what they called a three-tone sinusoidal replica, or a complicated sine wave sound, they found that people were able to perceive speech, when in fact there were no traditional speech sounds present in the signal. So rather than laughing at a reverse speech advocate, instead appreciate the fact that there is good science driving their perception of what they're hearing. They're not making anything up. They're just unaware of the natural explanation for their phenomenon. To better understand what these authors did in their experiment, listen to this brief cue consisting of nothing but sine waves. I'll play it three times.
It was a sunny day and the children were going to the park.
It almost does sound like speech, doesn't it? But it's not quite clear what it's saying. Well, suppose someone told you that it says,
"It was a sunny day and the children were going to the park."
Now listen to it again. I'll play it twice.
"It was a sunny day and the children were going to the park." "It was a sunny day and the children were going to the park."
This time, it's almost impossible not to hear the words that you've been preconditioned to hear. Let's play another one. This one is harder. I'll play the sine waves twice, then the words, then the sine waves twice again.
"Police returned to the museum." "Police returned to the museum."
"The police returned to the museum."
"Police returned to the museum." "Police returned to the museum."
Pretty cool, huh? There's a webpage by Matt Davis that lists some more of these, and you'll find a link to it on the online transcript for this episode at skeptoid.com. This phenomenon is called pareidolia, which we talked about not too long ago when we discussed the face on Mars. Pareidolia is the perceptual phenomenon by which we perceive familiar patterns in disorder. It is the brain's incredible computing power that lets us recognize people, understand language, and read handwriting. For the brain to have this capability, it necessarily results in the ability to perceive patterns where none in fact exists. Most of us can say, "Hey, that tree bark looks like Ernest Borgnine," without actually concluding that Ernest Borgnine has somehow become a tree. Our intelligence allows us to not make that mistake. But sometimes a horse might see a garden hose on the ground. Its pareidolia tells it that it's a snake, but it lacks sufficient intelligence to overcome the instinctive recognition. I'm not saying that reverse speech believers lack intelligence, only that they lack critical thinking skills, because there is a genuine gray area where it's hard to tell if a pattern is accidental or deliberate. But speech is a deliberate speaking action. So the reverse speech advocates do have a point they can make. It's not an accident of nature like the tree bark. Speech is the deliberate result of a speaker's brain communicating. What the reverse speech advocates are missing is that the well-known, well-understood, and well-evidenced phenomenon of pareidolia is a much more reasonable, simple, and probable explanation for why we can often perceive patterns in meaningless noise, in this case, reverse speech. This also fully explains a couple of other pop culture phenomena, satanic messages encoded in rock music played backwards, and EVP, the electronic voice phenomena claimed by ghost hunters. Here's a really popular clip, Jim Morrison of The Doors singing the line, "Treasure's There," from Break On Through.
"Treasure's there."
Now listen to it backwards. He says, "I am Satan." But to get it to sound like Satan, you have to be a little disingenuous with the razor blade. Here's what it says if you don't try to deliberately isolate the word Satan. More like Sata Schneigel. So if reverse speech is real, Jim Morrison's true intention in life was to inform us that he's Sata Schneigel. And as you can probably surmise, even that very impressive, "You're frightened, lean on me," is much less convincing without the incisive editing.
"You're frightened, lean on me, journey elm."
Really, you should be leaning on me, journey elm. This is what we call cherry-picking. Recordings of alleged ghost voices, usually called electronic voice phenomena, fall into three categories. First, hoaxes. Second, undetermined. And third and most commonly, audio pareidoliac cases of mistaken identification. You hear some random anomalous sound on the tape, and your brain does its best to make sense of it, often turning it into speech. If the words that the ghost hunters claim are spoken are at all indistinct or ambiguous, there's a very probable explanation for them that's not a ghost. You're hearing some sound, and unless you were present throughout the tape's entire history, which you probably weren't, it's some sound of unknown origin that, to your brain, sounds vaguely like speech. And isn't it interesting that it's always in the ghost hunter's own language and dialect? Here's a really good illustration of that. Listen to this song. It sounds like it's from India, but really I have no idea. I won't even remotely guess what language it's in. I don't speak it, and it's meaningless to my brain. But to me, it sounds quite clearly like someone saying, My lurid barn is fine, Benny Lava. Minor bun engine made Benny Lava. Anybody need this sign, Benny Lava? In Mirror 1, Divine Benny Lava. I could be high today. I see the nuns are gay. The words I heard are a little different from what someone else heard, as you can see from the subtitled video posted to YouTube, and you can get the link to it on the online transcript for this episode at skeptoid.com. YouTube is full of similar examples. The human brain is hardwired to hear its own language in otherwise meaningless noise. If it wasn't, you'd never be able to recognize your own name when someone calls out to you in a noisy room full of people. Whether that noise is human speech played backwards, music played backwards, traffic sounds, random noises in a graveyard or haunted house, or the musings of the great Indian poet Benny Lava, your human brain will process it and find intelligible speech. It's the way your brain works. It's not evidence of ghosts, satanic messages, and certainly not of something as childish as reverse speech.
That was very interesting. We'll be back right after this break.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of the many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666. Or contact us at aidsvancouver.org.
And we're back. Another topic discussed this week in the show was toxoplasmosis. Let's find a little bit more about this from a little bit of our web wisdom. Let's listen.
Hey gang, Dr. Mustache here. Are you a sloppy dresser? Kind of reckless? Do you get in more car accidents than the average person? Well, guess what? It's not your fault. Your cat may be to blame. New research links changes in human behavior with a cat parasite called Toxoplasma gondii. This parasite claims the cat as its primary host, but it can live in most warm-blooded animals. Toxoplasmosis is the disease that T. gondii creates. And since the 1920s, we've known that it can be potentially fatal to fetuses of pregnant women who come in contact with it. But new research points to the idea that toxoplasmosis can harmfully affect more people than just pregnant women. Cats excrete T. gondii oocysts, a gross-sounding word that basically just means their offspring, in their feces for 2 to 3 weeks after they become infected. Then other animals become infected by ingesting or inhaling the oocysts from the cat feces. Now, this can happen to people by eating raw meat, not being careful when you clean the litter box, or drinking contaminated water. Once the parasite has left the cat and infected another warm-bodied creature, it starts to make cysts inside the cells of the intermediate host's brain and tissues. Now, when that intermediate host dies, it'll be eaten by a cat, and thereby the T. gondii is returned to its original host. So it's hypothesized that the T. gondii parasite is actively influencing its return to the cat. How? Well, an infection of toxoplasmosis changes some of the chemical messages in the brain, and this can have a large effect on the host's behavior. In one study, mice and rats that were affected by the parasite made themselves more attractive to predators by being more active and visible, being less wary of the predators, and even going toward the scent of cats, something that's referred to as feline fatal attraction. These theorized behavioral manipulations result in the rodent dying and, if the T. gondii is lucky, being eaten by the cat. It has been shown that 1/3 of the world's population have been infected with toxoplasmosis. And until recently, it was believed that unless you had flu-like symptoms, were pregnant, or had a suppressed immune system, that you had a latent form of toxoplasmosis that was harmless. However, research in the early 2000s began to challenge this assumption. One prominent researcher, Yaroslav Flager, believes that the latent form of the parasite affects the way that our neurons communicate and changes our response to situations, our trust in other people, the way we dress and drive, our happiness, and even our mental stability. Flager believes that this latent form of the parasite gives people a mild form of fatal feline attraction and causes us to be less concerned for our own welfare. In Denmark, scientists were able to screen 45,000 women for the disease, and the results were clear. Women with a toxoplasma infection were 54% more likely to attempt to commit suicide, and twice as likely to succeed. And women who had the highest degree of infection were 91% more likely to attempt suicide than uninfected women were. Though most of the research and studies point to a correlation between the disease and behavioral changes, there's still no proof that the disease causes any of them. However, history provides an interesting link. The earliest modern examples of keeping cats as pets occurred in the mid-18th century, first in Paris and then in London, and primarily among artists and writers. Some people believe that schizophrenia was a rare disease prior to the mid-18th century, which is the same time that cats were being re-domesticated. Ready to stay away from cats forever? Well, most people think that you should be all right with an indoor cat that doesn't have much exposure to prey, and if you're careful when you're changing the litter box. But even so, it's theorized that this is only one of many parasites that have the potential to alter our behavior. So if it's not T. Gandhi, it's probably something else. Or you're just crazy. Anyways, I gotta go. My parasites are hungry. Talk to you soon.
Very scary. Very cool. It's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but, well, it's actually real and maybe affecting us all. I'm gonna let you stew about that for a little while. Well, we take yet another break, and we'll be back after this.
Here's something I wish I had. Magnetoreception, the ability to detect and navigate by magnetic fields. People have been pondering how animals navigate since time immemorial. And until the 1950s, scientists assumed that birds, at least, navigated the same way as ancient mariners. By the sun and the moon and the stars and, you know, sextants and astrolabes. But then everything changed when researchers in Germany were studying robins in a shuttered lab, and they realized that come migration time, the birds all started trying to get out of the same side of the cage. Specifically, the side of the cage that Spain was on, which is where they all wanted to go. Since then, experiments have suggested over and over again that a variety of organisms, trout, bees, bacteria, turtles, birds, maybe even cows, can detect magnetic fields and navigate by them. We just can't figure out how the frick they're doing it. But research continues. This very year, in 2012, a team of researchers at Germany's Ludwig Maximilian University came up with a theory. It could be that some navigating animals have specialized cells that contain magnetite, the strongest naturally magnetic material on Earth. It's already been shown that trout's facial nerves respond to electric signals when exposed to magnetic fields. So the German team scraped some cells out of a rainbow trout's nose and put them in a microscope surrounded by magnetic coils and a rotating magnetic field. What they found is that some cells, maybe 1 in 10,000, actually spun in unison with the rotating magnetic field. These cellular magnets are tiny, but they responded to the magnetic field with about 100 times more force than the researchers predicted. The researchers theorized that these compass cells contain microscopic crystals of magnetite, or maybe some other iron-rich mineral, and that nearby nerve cells pick up their spinning and transmit that information to the fish's brain to give it directions. Very clever. But another mechanism for detecting magnetic fields could be in the eyes. Birds and a host of other animals have retinas that are chock full of a protein called cryptochrome. And cryptochrome can produce molecules called radicals, which have unpaired electrons. Now, I'll spare you the details here, but pairs of these radicals can interact in such a way that they're affected by magnetic fields. And since these reactions are taking place in the eye, it's possible that cryptochrome can actually allow animals to see magnetic fields. And wait! Those animals could include us. Yes, we have cryptochrome in our retinas too. Scientists are investigating a particular kind called Cry2 that's known to function in other animals as a light-sensitive magnetic sensor. Now, it's still not clear why birds can fly thousands of miles without a map, while I can't find my way out of the Arby's parking lot, but Cry2 might explain why some people just have a sense of which direction to go, even in a new environment. As with all things, time and science will tell. You might say that magnetoreception is a field of research that we're still feeling our way through.
And we're back. Yet another topic that was covered in the Ig Nobel Prizes was the idea of magnetoperception. So let's find out a little bit more about that, and yet another bit of web wisdom.
Here's something I wish I had. Magnetoreception, the ability to detect and navigate by magnetic fields. People have been pondering how animals navigate since time immemorial. And until the 1950s, scientists assumed that birds, at least, navigated the same way as ancient mariners. By the sun and the moon and the stars and, you know, sextants and astrolabes. But then, everything changed when researchers in Germany were studying robins in a shuttered lab, and they realized that come migration time, the birds all started trying to get out of the same side of the cage. Specifically, the side of the cage that Spain was on, which is where they all wanted to go. Since then, experiments have suggested over and over again that a variety of organisms, trout, bees, bacteria, turtles, birds, maybe even cows, can detect magnetic fields and navigate by them. We just can't figure out how the frick they're doing it. But research continues. This very year, in 2012, a team of researchers at Germany's Ludwig Maximilian University came up with a theory. It could be that some navigating animals have specialized cells that contain magnetite, the strongest naturally magnetic material on Earth. It's already been shown that trout's facial nerves respond to electric signals when exposed to magnetic fields. So the German team scraped some cells out of a rainbow trout's nose and put them in a microscope surrounded by magnetic coils and a rotating magnetic field. What they found is that some cells, maybe 1 in 10,000, actually spun in unison with the rotating magnetic field. These cellular magnets are tiny, but they responded to the magnetic field with about 100 times more force than the researchers predicted. The researchers theorized that these compass cells contain microscopic crystals of magnetite, or maybe some other iron-rich mineral, and that nearby nerve cells pick up their spinning and transmit that information to the fish's brain to give it directions. Very clever. But another mechanism for detecting magnetic fields could be in the eyes. Birds and a host of other animals have retinas that are chock full of a protein called cryptochrome. And cryptochrome can produce molecules called radicals, which have unpaired electrons. Now, I'll spare you the details here, but pairs of these radicals can interact in such a way that they're affected by magnetic fields. And since these reactions are taking place in the eye, it's possible that cryptochrome can actually allow animals to see magnetic fields. And wait! Those animals could include us. Yes, we have cryptochrome in our retinas too. Scientists are investigating a particular kind called Cry2 that's known to function in other animals as a light-sensitive magnetic sensor. Now, it's still not clear why birds can fly thousands of miles without a map, while I can't find my way out of the Arby's parking lot, but Cry2 might explain why some people just have a sense of which direction to go, even in a new environment. As with all things, time and science will tell. You might say that magnetoreception is a field of research that we're still feeling our way through.
Isn't that cool? And I've been reading recently that there is the possibility, at least really early days, but you can actually put some drops into your eyes and you should be able to see magnetic fields. Would that not be like way cool? Well, we'll be back after this break.
We be, A Jihad for Love, Whitewater Black Gold, A Red Girl's Guide to Reasoning, East Hastings Pharmacy, Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, Misrepresentation.
Cinema Politica UBC screens politically charged films with speakers and discussions every month. Screenings take place at the Norm Theater in the Sub and are by donation. To learn more, visit cinemapolitica.org/UBC.
And we're back. Okay, so now I'm going to switch things around a little bit. Recently, Israel outlawed fluoridation of water. This has been one of the things, kind of like an anti-vax movement, kind of like, ooh, they're trying to get us somehow. And, well, I thought I'd play a bit of a web wisdom bit about fluoridation and, well, why it isn't going to hurt you. So let's sit back and listen to this.
Every once in a while, chain emails or Facebook posts make their way back into prominence. It happened last year with HPV killing girls. Recently, it seems to be fluoride. A number of you have been forwarding me a post from last year, which features a meta-analysis published a few years before that on fluoride and IQ. Fluoride is the topic of this week's healthcare triage. So let's talk about the Facebook post and the study it's covering. Researchers wanted to look at studies examining a relationship between fluoride exposure and delayed neurobehavioral development. They found 27 epidemiological studies that were on point. When they combined the results, they found that people who were exposed to high levels of fluoride had an IQ which was lower by 0.45 points. It was statistically significant. Now let's discuss. Of the 27 studies, 25 appear to be from China. The other two are from Iran. I bring this up not to disparage those countries' ability to do research, but to point out that they have very different background levels of fluoride than what we might see in the United States. In some of these studies, fluoride levels reached 11.5 milligrams per liter. Compare that to New York City, which shoots for 0.7 to 1.2 milligrams per liter. Moreover, some of the kids got their fluoride from inhaling it from coal burning, or because it was a pollutant. That's not the same thing as fluoridation here in the United States. These were not randomized controlled trials, but epidemiologic studies. Lots of other factors could be contributing. Schooling, arsenic, iodine, even lead, which often wasn't measured in these studies, could be in play here. We can't say which of these things is causing the result. And what does a difference of 0.45 in IQ scores really mean? That is really small. In fact, as the researchers point out in the paper, it may be within the measurement error of the test itself. This isn't the first time people have gotten up in arms about fluoride. Some argue that it has many risks, including those to the brain, thyroid gland, and bones. Others make much more alarmist statements, calling fluoride a corrosive poison. Websites and publications raising concerns about fluoride offer scientific references and expert quotes that really could cause concern that the fluoride in your water not only doesn't help you, but it could also be hurting you. You know where this is going, right? To the research. Overwhelming evidence has existed for over 60 years that proves the efficacy of water fluoridation. Some of the best studies come from the early days of fluoridation because it was easier then to find groups of people who were not exposed to any fluoride sources. In a 15-year landmark study from Grand Rapids, Michigan, children who received fluoridated water from birth had 50 to 63% less tooth decay than children from a nearby city in Michigan who drank non-fluoridated water. Evidence for how well fluoride works is massive. A compilation of the results of 113 studies in 23 countries showed reductions in tooth decay for both baby teeth and adult teeth. People with fluoride in their water had 40 to 49% less tooth decay in baby teeth and 50 to 59% less tooth decay in adult teeth. Another compilation of studies conducted between 1976 through 1987 showed reductions in tooth decay between 15 and 60%, with the highest benefit for those with baby teeth, but significant health benefits for adults who already had their permanent teeth. The 350 peer-reviewed references compiled by the American Dental Association in their publication Fluoride Facts also support how well fluoride works. Of course, preventing cavities might not be worth endangering your health in other ways. So is fluoride really safe? Once again, the scientific evidence overwhelmingly supports the safety of adding fluoride to a community water supply. Reviews of the safety of fluoride by the Institute of Medicine, the Food and Nutrition Board, the National Research Council of the United States, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Public Health Service, and the World Health Organization have all led to the conclusion that fluoride supplementation is safe, effective, and recommended for community water supplies. A systematic review published in 2000 in the BMJ analyzed 214 studies on fluoridation and found no evidence of potential adverse effects except for dental fluorosis, which I'll get to in a moment. Periodic reviews every 6 years by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, continue to find no harmful effects related to fluoride in drinking water. Good scientific studies demonstrate that drinking fluoridated water doesn't increase the risk of hip fractures. More than 50 extremely large studies do not show any association between fluoridation and the risk of cancer. One small study from the 1950s, which a surprisingly large number of you have read, looked at 15 patients with an overly active thyroid gland, which tried to use large amounts of fluoride as a treatment and found that it seemed to help some patients. On that basis, concerns have been raised about whether fluoride in drinking water adversely affects the thyroid gland. Again, much better science says that the answer is no. Studies from people with drinking water with naturally high levels of fluoride found that it had no effect on their thyroid gland size or function, and this matches results from animal studies. Furthermore, two studies have found that no association exists between the level of fluoride in water and thyroid cancer. The National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences supports the conclusion that drinking optimally fluoridated water is not a genetic hazard. There is no known association between drinking fluoridated water and Down syndrome. One psychiatrist in the 1950s published two studies claiming that the two were connected, but four subsequent studies have found no connection, and experienced researchers have noted significant problems with how that psychiatrist analyzed his data. There's also no generally accepted scientific evidence establishing a link between fluoridated water and other neurologic disorders, including attention deficit disorder. There's a study in which rats were administered fluoride at 125 times the level in community fluoridated water and concluded that the rats showed some behavioral changes. However, this study did not use any sort of control group to compare the rats who had the fluoride to rats that did not. And scientists who reviewed the results of this study have concluded that it is significantly flawed and cannot be used to draw conclusions about problems with fluoridated water. There is one real problem that can result from too much fluoride, and that's dental fluorosis. This is a discoloration of the teeth that can occur when a child ingests more fluoride than is recommended. With mild dental fluorosis, the teeth get white flecks or spots. But with severe fluorosis, the teeth can develop a permanent brown stain. About 10% of the mild fluorosis seen in children does probably come from the fluoridation of water, although the dentists argue that these small white flecks are a small price to pay for avoiding cavities, tooth decay, missed school, and so on. The bigger cause of fluorosis is likely that kids do sometimes have a habit of swallowing their toothpaste. Fluorosis is the reason that the American Dental Association recommends that children under 6 do not use more than a pea-sized amount of toothpaste. We assume that little kids are going to swallow it, and if they swallow a lot more than that pea-sized amount, they're more likely to get fluorosis. Toothpaste delivers a much more concentrated amount of fluoride than drinking water does, so the biggest cause of fluorosis is likely swallowed toothpaste, not water. Many experts have concluded that fluoride is both beneficial and safe in the drinking water of our communities, and they agree that the risk of fluorosis is far outweighed by the benefits of preventing tooth decay. The American Dental Association, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the American Medical Association, and the U.S. Surgeon General have all issued statements supporting how well adding fluoride to water works to prevent tooth decay. In fact, the CDC declared fluoridation of public drinking water to be one of the 10 biggest public health achievements of the 20th century. Too much of anything can be bad, including fluoride. I don't dispute that. But we shouldn't overlook the fact that dental caries are still the most common chronic disease in kids aged 6 to 19. Let's not go backwards. Ignore this chain email.
I could not agree more. It's hard sometimes to separate pseudoscience from real science, fake skepticism from real skepticism. That's why you need to have a very robust tool set of logic and critical thinking. But on that note, let's take a little bit of a break and we'll be back after this.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
And we're back. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit. Noam Chomsky is one of the, I think, great thinkers of the, well, non-capitalist movement. He's more of a lefty libertarian than a socialist or communist like myself is. But he did an interview at one point where he was talking about, well, if we had this sort of socialist or communist utopia, lazy people would just sit back and they wouldn't do any work and they would just waste their time, and it would be a burden. They would be a burden to society. So he takes us on this question, and he answers it in a way I think is very effective and worthy to share with my loyal listeners. So let's take a listen to Noam Chomsky as he answers the idea, is work a burden, or is it something that we like to do as a species?
Bother to work in it. You think that's a valid objection? What about those that don't want to work?
Well, it's an interesting concept. Actually, this is one of the things in which I've differed for some time on the with the Paracon people. Mm. They basically have the same view. Mike Alward, Robin Hanel, and the others, we've disagreed about this for many years. It's a question of what you think work is. I mean, there is a point of view associated with capitalist systems that holds that work is a burden. If you weren't driven to work, you'd prefer to vegetate. I don't think that has anything to do with human beings. And in fact, it's kind of striking that the people who hold this view, most of them come from the university or scientific backgrounds. Well, you go into, say, the university where I work, MIT, mainly scientific university, and people are working 80 hours a day, 80 hours a week, because they love their work. And their work is under their own control, you know, of all the social institutions. These especially science-based universities are places where you really do control your own work. I mean, you got to meet some conditions, but it's pretty much controlled by participants. So, you know, optimally and, in fact, often realistically. And under those conditions, people just want to work. The carpenters who love what they're doing and can control it, they work all the time. And in fact, you know, there's an old tradition from the Enlightenment, which is, you know, came out, grew into classical liberalism and finally anarchism, which holds that work is one of the highest ideals of life. Creative work under your own control. And I think most people know that that's true. When you have an opportunity to do creative work under your own control, with especially if it has some social purpose and so on, you know, it's the best thing to do. It's a lot better than, you know, lying on a couch and watching a boring television program. So I just think it's the wrong. It's a concept of work that comes out of capitalist ideology, which says people have to be driven to work. Actually, it's very interesting to watch the debates about this. It's debated in mainstream circles, not so much in these terms. But take a look at the debates about taxation of the wealthy. The standard argument against taxing the wealthy is, well, if you put high taxes on the wealthy, they're not going to do anything. And they're the ones who invest and make things happen and so on and so forth. Now, the people who press this most are economists. And sometimes it's almost comical. There was an article, one of the major journals, by a well-known Harvard economist, liberal economist, Greg Mankiw, wrote the major texts. And he argued, he said, look, you can't, he's kind of a liberal. He says, you can't tax the rich because they're not going to do anything. And then there's no economic theory behind it or any other theory. But he gives an example of himself. He says, well, if I didn't have a high salary, I wouldn't do anything. You'd never get anyone in a university saying that except from an economics department. And that's because the ideology is so built in. They can't think. They can't look at the next office and see that a guy's in the lab all day because he loves what he's doing. Of course people want to do meaningful work, especially if they can run it themselves. The Paracon position that I've disagreed with is they believe that pay remuneration ought to be proportional to input. You know, the harder you work, the more you should be paid. But I think that's a very demeaning conception of not only of what work is, but what human beings are like. And I don't even think it's true. You know, in fact, they themselves work very hard and they don't get paid for it. So are they different from other people? You know?
On that note, I think I'm going to end the show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Next week, we should have some exciting more science news and such. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths.
This is a song about prejudice. And the language of prejudice. And the power of the language of prejudice. It's called prejudice. In our modern free-spoken society, there is a word that we still hold taboo. A word with a terrible history of being used to abuse, oppress and subdue. Just six seemingly harmless letters arranged in a way that will form a word with more power than the pieces of metal that are forged to make swords. A couple of G's, an R and an E, an I and an N. Just six little letters, all jumbled together, have caused damage that we may never mend. And it's important that we all respect that if these people should happen to choose to reclaim the word as their own, it doesn't mean the rest of you have a right to its use. So never underestimate the power that language imparts. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can break hearts. A couple of G's, cheese, unless you've had to live it. An R and an E, even I am careful with it. An I and an N, in the end it will only offend. Don't wanna have to spell it out again. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. So listen to me, if you care for your health, you won't call me ginger unless you ginger yourself. Yeah, only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yep. When you are a ginger, life is pretty hard. Years of ritual bullying in the schoolyard. Kids call in your anger and fanny pants. No invitation to the high school dance. But you get up and learn to hold your head up. You try to keep your cool and not get head up. But until the feeling of ill is truly let up, then the word is ours and ours alone. Don't you know that only a ginger can call another ginger ginger? If only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. So if you call us ginge, we just might come unhinged. If you don't have a fringe with at least a tinge of the ginge in it, only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Now listen to me, we're not looking for sympathy, just because we're sensitive to UV. Just cause we're pathetically pale, we do alright with the females. Yeah, I like to ask the ladies round for ginger beer, and soon they're running their fingers through my ginger beard and dunking my ginger nuts into their ginger tea, yeah.
and asking, can they call me Ginger? And I say, I don't think that's appropriate, because only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yeah. And all the ladies, they agree, it's a fact. Once you're gone, ginger, you can't go back. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yeah, go, ginger, go, you funky motherfucking ginger. Bozo or fire truck. You can even call us carrot top or blood nut. Yeah, you can call us matchstick or tampon. But fucking with the G word is just not on. If you're a gingerphobe and you don't like us, we will stand up to the fight if you want to fight us. But